south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. Hey, how about a little story? You know, all the little stories I tell here on The Expat Files are unusual and can only happen here in Latin America, which is what makes them so interesting. Because, you know, everyone who's listening to this program is ultimately thinking about moving here, right? I mean, that's your Plan B initiative. Whether it happens to you or not is completely up to you and circumstances, whether under your control or beyond your control. But in lieu of having actual boots on the ground here yourself, you can always count on me to come through with some weird, fantastic, funny, and, well, outrageous stories. And every one of them, I guarantee, will have a little moral or a lesson to be learned. All with the intent of trying to stop you from stepping in the same potholes a lot of us green gringos and expats did when we first got down. Now, you've heard me mention one of my very first expat insider seminar attendees, who we affectionately referred to as Bitcoin Dan. You longtime listeners heard me tell the story of how he and his new wife drove an RV all the way down from the socialist people's paradise of Canada. That's how he gratingly refers to it. Being that he was in the 60 or 70% tax bracket, you know, if you add it all together, he's right. And what you pay up in the States is not much less than that. Anyway, after many of his own wild and crazy adventures, just getting that RV down here to Central America, you wonder why anybody would ever try that in the first place. By the way, when people ask me how badly border customs authorities shake you down when you drive a vehicle through, well, Dan's story is a good test case. First of all, when you drive any vehicle through, you're a target because you've got U.S. or Canadian first world plates. It's obvious everywhere you go that there's a gringo on board. So take a guess which country gave him the biggest shakedown at the border. Remember, he drove from Montreal down through the States, past the Mexican border, and then through the Mexican-Guatemala border. Now, naturally, from all you've heard about Mexico, you'd say, definitely, the Mexicans shook him down. Well, that's true. They shook him down a lot of times, and he had some decoy computers on board to give away when he got pulled over. But the first time, it wasn't by the cops. It was by an armed group of Mexican thieves in cars and motorcycles. In fact, he said it was very strategic. As soon as he passed the U.S.-Mexican border, he was told the first Mexican police checkpoint he'd come across was about 50 miles down into Mexico. Now, wouldn't you know it, about halfway between the U.S.-Mexican border and the next checkpoint, 50 miles away, that group of Mexican thieves pulled alongside, pointed some guns, and said, pull over. Welcome to Mexico. Bienvenidos a Mexico. And believe it or not, they didn't want anything from the trailer, nothing big and bulky. They just wanted money. And the amount, they said, 200 cash. Now, of course, if he didn't give them 200 bucks, they'd probably take everything. But you have to know, the Mexican cops are in on that kind of stuff all the way. I mean, exactly halfway between the next police stop, they get pulled over. So that was the first event, and he got pulled over a few more times along the way. So he kept getting nickel and dimed, 100 here, 100 there. Usually, surprise, surprise, from the Mexican cops themselves. But he was ready for that. I'd warned people on a couple of my shows. Don't have anything of real value out in the open. Have a cheap phone, cheap watch, and maybe a decoy computer, an oldie, laying around, maybe on the back seat. A computer's always a nice, juicy item to grab. They'll never know whether it's 6 months old or even 5 years old. Of course, you can see why it's not a very good idea to drive your car through Mexico. However, things completely changed once he hit the Mexico-Guatemala border. Like you heard me say in a past show, the cops kind of turn into Barney Fife. And since they see so few gringos coming through, because Guatemala is way off the gringo tourist trail, pulling over a gringo is kind of the highlight of a cop's week, or even month. And you can bet you'll be the subject of the conversation around the dinner table at night. Hey, guess what? I pulled over a gringo today. Now, Mexico's got a border with Belize, too. I've been through that one a number of times. Now, the cops in Belize are not as laid back as Latin cops. First of all, it's an English-speaking country, so they've seen a lot of gringos. A lot of very wealthy and upscale gringos, too, because they've got those very nice Coral Island white sand beach caves you've heard so much about. And the cops there, even though they're lazy dumbasses, too, they know if they stop you, they can detain you for a long, long time. Even for nothing. Most of the time it's for nothing. But they'll take your papers and sit down in their cars for a half hour, 45 minutes. That is, until you start waving the Grants, the Franklins, or the Benjamins around. However, you're not going to see that in Honduras or Guatemala, Salvador, even Nicaragua. Though more so in Nicaragua these days because the gringos are piling in there too. But again, when you're off the gringo tourist trail, countries like Bolivia, Paraguay, Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, the cops pull over gringos so rarely. Man, in most cases, you can't believe how genuinely friendly they are and glad to see you. What I mean is, if you're down here off the gringo tourist trail long enough, you'll really get to know what it feels like to be a B-grade rock star. You know, like the bass player in a popular band. Nobody knows his name or can even recognize him on an album cover, but he gets preferential treatment, free passes, and invites to all the cool parties. So anyway, Bitcoin Dan, once he got through the Mexican-Guatemala border, didn't get stopped once in Guatemala. No police, roadblocks, pullovers, or extortion attempts at all. However, in Mexico, about every 100 miles or so. By the way, I think he got into 3 accidents on the way down. Small ones. A couple of little fender benders, all settled without the cops, 100 or so passing between hands. No lawyers, cops, or insurance companies. So, back to the original question. What country gave him the biggest border shakedown? If you guessed Mexico, that's logical, but you'd be wrong. He said, as it turns out, as soon as he left Montreal and hit the U.S. border, the U.S. Border Control officials went into his RV, rifled through his stuff for at least a half an hour, and asked him a bunch of questions. Now, you got to remember, this guy is traveling with his new wife. He's the cleanest cut-looking guy you ever saw. Plus, he's sincere and one of the most polite guys you'll ever meet, too. Remember, this guy worked for Microsoft for a couple of years. In fact, he was such a valuable programmer, he said that every week they'd fly him back and forth from Montreal to Silicon Valley so that he'd be able to spend weekends at home in Montreal. Not a bad gig, huh? But guess what? He quit to start his own company. So anyway, he said they gave him more than the third degree when he hit the U.S. border. The U.S.-Mexican border wasn't that much fun either. Big waits, long lines and stuff. A lot of street vendors and beggars pulling and tugging on you. Man, don't you hate that? But then again, Latin America is a touchy-feely society with a different idea of personal space than you're used to, that's for sure. Unfortunately, the touchy-feely hawkers and beggars converge in places where there are a lot of gringos. And why is that? Well, that's where the money is, right? Which is why I like being off the gringo tourist trail so much. Sure, there are beggars. I mean, there's beggars everywhere. Hey, Chicago's probably got 30,000 of them. Speaking of Chicago, the other day, I was driving around, I saw a tienda. You know, they all have their own particular names. It was called Tienda de Chicago Loop. Tienda, of course, means little store. Now, the Chicago thing I get, but the loop? Who would know what the loop was unless you lived there? And perhaps been kicked out or deported. Or not. Because we're talking about a real scruffy, rundown neighborhood here. And the loop in Chicago, well, that's first world high end. Anyway, the difference is, even in the biggest Latin cities off the gringo tourist trail, on the busiest corners where there's a lot of backed up traffic, you'll see people selling stuff. They'll be shilling their mops and toys and windshield wipers, and of course there'll be the guys washing down your windshield. But you see, 95% or more of these people are selling something, so they're making a living. If you want to call it that, or surviving. Then there's that tiny 5% that are begging, maybe one or two people at a very busy street corner, usually a mom with a couple of kids strapped on her back. Then there's the ubiquitous old guy pushing someone around in a wheelchair begging for money. See that everywhere. But like I said, most of them are out there selling something, even if it's candy, bubble gum, or homemade baked goods, a lot of that too. Oh, and there's street performers. Jugglers, magicians, acrobats, fire breathers. Yep, fire breathers. And we're not talking from the Chili Peppers either. And just lately, I've seen quite a few guys on street corners juggling machetes. Not dull ones either, because they'll slice a few things in front of you to prove it. One of my favorite is the guy that stands on the shoulders of another guy while he juggles 4, not 3 machetes that are, get this, on fire. Cirque du Soleil, eat your heart out. I mean it, some of these guys could be in Cirque, except, you know, wrong place, wrong time, wrong language, wrong country. But actual beggars with their hand out? Just a tiny few. However, once you're on the gringo tourist trail, man, begging is a racket. They know, especially new green gringos, are a soft touch. Now, if you travel a lot in third world countries, you know, when you land at an airport, as soon as you walk out those big glass doors and you get that blast of tropical air and the taxis are out in front, just one look and a couple of steps forward and you'll know whether that country's on or off the gringo tourist trail. Because, you see, if you're off the tourist trail, no one's gonna rush you. There won't be a little tribe of people following you around trying to push food, trinkets, and t-shirts on you. Nope, there'll be no sad-looking moms shoving big-eyed, snotty-nosed kids in your faces, begging for a handout. You just don't see that kind of stuff at airports way off the gringo tourist trail. However, when you're on the gringo tourist trail, look out. By the way, a lot of baggage switch scams going on when you first land in a gringoized area. Though some gringo tourists stay at deluxe first-class hotels, so they've got private shuttle service coming from their hotel. But for most people, they land, get their bags, venture out cautiously into the wave of sweaty masses. That's when the taxi drivers start fighting over you. And when they do, look out for that baggage handoff switch. Now, it's never happened to me, but I've talked to a few gringos who've had that nasty experience. No fun when you first arrive and you lose a piece of luggage. Forever. But where were we? Oh yeah. Bitcoin Dan and his RV were delayed at the US-Mexican border on the Mexican side, but that's to be expected at any Latin land border crossing. Suddenly it's manana time and there's lots of paperwork bringing a car or a vehicle through the border. But they didn't rifle through it like the US border cops did. Now you know, when you hit the southern border of Mexico, you could go straight through to Guatemala or Belize. I've done them both many times. And by and large, the Guatemalan cops, especially the ones out in the boonies, are like Barney Fife. There's just so few gringos coming through, they're happy to see one. In fact, more than happy at a routine police stop to bore you with the fact that cousin Tulio's got a successful drywall business in Newark. Do you know him? He does good work, so next time you've got a drywall job, do look him up and tell him cousin Yaco sent you. So you play along because, well, he's a cop. However, if you're driving from Mexico on through to Belize, you'll find as a general rule, a cop's a little more rude, a little more curt, a little more jaded, a lot more angry, and don't seem to like their jobs much. And why is that? Well, I know a couple of gringos who've lived a long time in Belize, and they tell me, since it's an English-speaking country, and they've got those beautiful Ks, you know, those coral islands, they get lots of gringo tourists, and most all of them have money, well, a lot more than any Belizean, you know, it's a very poor country. And the cops who come across gringos with nice cars and a lot more money than they'll ever have often use their power to squeeze you. So even if your papers are 100% in order, they know at a police roadblock or stop they can detain you for as long as they feel like it. And you know, gringos and expats were always in a hurry. And the little Christmas, New Year's, birthday, or whatever gift of 20 or 50 bucks will get you to the front of the roadblock post haste. By the way, if you ever take a ride through Belize, you'll see some extremely poor neighborhoods. It's no wonder why so many of them have a kind of a chip on their shoulder when they run up against a wealthy gringo in a nice car. In fact, one expat in Belize told me the fact that the Belizeans speak English, though a big bonus for Americans, tends to drive an even bigger wedge between the locals and the gringos. Since unlike poor Latinos who don't understand English, the Belizeans understand every comment, complaint, and slur gringos make inadvertently or not about the Belizeans, their habits, their country, and their culture. Now, I know that gringos living in a hot, sweaty, backward country can be edgy and irritable and often complain more than they should, mostly about things they can't change. Unfortunately, in Belize, the walls have ears. In the rest of Latin America, however, they don't speak English. Which is why you could still be a big jerk in most of Latin America and the Latins will still like you. So anyway, back in around 2012, Bitcoin Dan came down to my seminar. And you may have heard me say this before, but after the seminar, he said, Johnny, I'm staying, but I have to look for a place to rent. In the meantime, can I park my RV out in front of your place just for a couple of weeks till I find a place myself? Well, that couple of weeks turned into 4, 5, or even 6 months. Can't remember. But here's what I do remember. right around a month into it, he knocked on my door and said, "Hey, Johnny, listen, thanks for letting us stay outside in the RV. And I really want to give you something for it." And I said, "No, Dan, it's no trouble." And he handed me a little piece of paper with a barcode on it. I said, "What's this?" He said, "It's an address for a Bitcoin." And I said, "A Bitcoin? What am I supposed to do with it?" He said, "Hold on to it, because there's a chance, a pretty good chance, that someday it'll be worth a lot of money." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And he said, "Well, right now it's worth about 11 bucks, but there's a chance it could go up to, now don't laugh, 5 or even 10,000 bucks, or even multiples of that when the fiat currency systems start crashing." And I said, "For one of them?" He said, "Yeah, just one." Now, at that point, I knew Dan was big into gaming. In fact, sometimes at 2 or 3 in the morning, I'd see that ghostly flicker of a computer monitor screen. At all hours, he'd be gaming with people from all over the world. Now, you see, at that time, Bitcoin was just starting to be used by gamers, whose protocols had become so sophisticated that most all dedicated gamers would necessarily, to have the advantage over other gamers, have to buy more and more virtual accessories, like swords, guns, tanks, spaceships, armor, ammo, whatever. So gamers started using Bitcoin to buy accessories. Much easier and faster to transfer that stuff around than dollars. Anyway, so Dan gave me a Bitcoin. At the time, worth, I think, 11 bucks. And now, today, I still have that Bitcoin. And of course, that was a pre-fork Bitcoin. It came long before any of the forks to Bitcoin Gold or Bitcoin Cash, or now it's Bitcoin Diamond, I hear. And the value of that Bitcoin, you could call it rent for keeping his RV outside for, call it 6 months. Would you believe over $12,000? So the question is, would you accept $12,000 rent for someone to park their RV in front of your house for 6 months? Hey, you know, this kind of stuff could only happen in Latin America. In the States, you wouldn't be able to park and live with an RV in a residential neighborhood. Someone would call the cops on you within a couple of days. The homeowner would get a fine, the RV owner would get a fine, and they'd surely impound it. Hey, you know, if you live up in the States, there are so many thousands and thousands of laws and regulations, people commit at least 3 felonies a day and don't even know it. But you knew it, right? So anyway, at my upcoming January 2018 Expat Insider Seminar, none other than Bitcoin Dan will be giving a couple-hour spiel. Anything and everything you wanted to know about the cryptocurrency world from a guy who, let's face it, lives and breathes that stuff. Not to mention, he's the very first person in the world to teach a cryptocurrency course at an accredited university, and he's still doing it. That's one of the added attractions if you come to my January Expat Insider Seminar. After all, there's no hotter topic in the world than Bitcoin. Oh, and by the way, at our very last Expat Insider Seminar in July, there were a lot of very instructional cryptocurrency discussions. Dan was hanging around at the seminar. Of course, he was sort of leading those discussions too, as you might imagine. And at the time, around 5 months ago, Bitcoin was hovering between 2,000 and 2,500. And after gathering up some of that information, some of our attendees bought Bitcoin right when they were at the seminar, or at least made arrangement to put in their orders. To say the least, they are very happy campers right now, up at least 400% in 5 months. So then, is it a bubble? For sure it's a bubble. How big can the bubble blow before, well, there's a huge correction? Well, there's going to be huge corrections all the time. But you know, there's some very big things in the works. Institutional investors are dying to get in, but they have to find the vehicles. And they are coming right along, right down the pike, very shortly. So everybody asks the question, how much higher? Well, since I'm not the expert, I guess you'll just have to come down to my January Expat Insider Seminar and hear it from the horse's mouth. Oh, and one last thing about that day, Dan gave me that one Bitcoin. Hey, I didn't even have a Bitcoin wallet yet, you know? Didn't even know what a Bitcoin wallet was or how to get one. Anyway, I said, "Dan, thanks a lot for this Bitcoin. Can I ask you how you know this stuff's going to go up in value and the rest of the world will catch on?" Well, he said, "I read the white paper from Shishito. Both me and my brother did." Then he said, "The only thing that could really shut it down right now is if governments came in and banned it." Now remember, this was 2012, 5 years ago, when Bitcoin was having all those little growing pains. If you remember, it was declared DOA, that's dead on arrival, at least 9 times by professional financial gurus and pundits. Oh, it got kicked back down 9 or 10 times, all right, but each time it came back stronger than ever. And now, like Dan said, it's too big to kill. But back to what he said. He said, "You know, Johnny, I'm sure this thing's going to go way up. My brother says so too. And I said, well, who's your brother? Because I'd never met him. He said, well, he's the only guy I know who's smarter than I am. Anyway, if you want to catch up with the very most current state-of-the-art in cryptocurrencies, come down to my Expat Insider Seminar. You know how to sign up, don't you? Just go to the newexpat.com website and click on Johnny's seminar link. We're exactly a month away from launch, so you've still got time. And remember, when you sign up, you'll get an hour-long one-on-one phone call with me, too, so we can discuss the seminar details or anything having to do with your own Plan B. All right, let's go into reverse for a second. You know, Cuba's been opened up to American tourism and then kicked back on the gray list again, right? And lately, I've been seeing blogs and articles, even getting emails for promotions from travel writers, etc., people supposedly in the know, telling me all about the wonders of living the expat life in Cuba. Yeah, and you know what? None of them actually seem to be living there. They've all visited a few times. I've been there a few times myself. And I'll tell you this, you'll never learn the real Cuba unless you speak some Spanish and get out of the tourist areas. That means get out of Havana and Varadero Beach, which most gringos and expats never seem to do. So no matter what you've heard about Cuba and or whatever promotions are out there trying to sell you on the idea that you can actually live the good life in Cuba, well, I can tell you this, unless you have a lot of money to continuously hang out at four-star hotels and resorts, yep, they've got a few and they're really expensive. If, however, you're not independently wealthy and you have to make a living, that is, start a business or work to supplement your income down there, chances are you will end up regretting it. That said, I was recently sent this little blurb from a very knowledgeable gringo who spent a lot of time in Cuba. I'll paraphrase and add my comments as usual. This piece has the generous and kind title, get this, Cuba, the worst piece of shit communist dictatorship in the world. It starts, I couldn't get close to making it just 10 reasons, so here's 15 reasons. Number one, everyone will try and scam you 24 hours a day, even if your Cuban friend is standing right next to you, telling them that you know the real price of things. They'll still try to gouge you. Now, you might love the old cars. You see them everywhere. But the pollution from those old cars is horrible. You cannot even breathe in some parts of the city. Even in your apartment, you're going to have trouble breathing. So much for living in Havana. Remember, all those cars were built way before there were any kind of pollution or emission controls. And even if they were so equipped, that stuff would have long since rotted and rusted off, never to be replaced because no one's checking. Just like in the 50s and the 60s back in the States, no one cares. Number three, where the people live, it's one of the ugliest, most dilapidated countries in the world, with one of the worst infrastructures. Almost all the buildings are pre-Castro, and no one does anything to fix them up. From a distance, they look sort of majestic, but as you get closer, they're falling apart. As far as I can see, the government puts no money into anything. And there really is no economy except tourism. Number four, there's nothing to buy, even if you have money. One day you've got products, the next day you don't, so you better buy it while it's there. Number five, it's an island, but it takes you an hour to get to a decent beach from Havana. And the taxis want $50 to take you there, which is more than a month's salary for the average guy. The system's all screwed up. And if you stay at a nice hotel by the beach, it's more expensive than any other one you can get in Bahamas or Jamaica or anywhere. Number six, unless you're staying in an all-inclusive first-world hotel, the food is horrific. You'll be eating rice, beans, and chicken and every variation of it every day. Number seven, again, unless you're in a first-class first-world hotel, there are no clean toilets or clean toilet seats. Sometimes no toilet seats, no toilet paper, no soap. So definitely bring a large stash of wipes and don't buy them in country because you'll pay 10 times the price. But don't worry, they rarely stock them. Number eight, there is barely an internet. Even if you're in an upscale hotel, you'll pay $4 an hour for an internet that simply crawls along like a dial-up modem. So then how are you supposed to have a business in Cuba? Every business has some internet component these days, so forget about it. By the way, as far as private homes and such having internet in Havana, the biggest city in Cuba, as of March 2017, they were just rolling out private internet service. With, get this, only 400 private clients and houses having internet up till then. So, what's it cost to sign up now? You'll get 30 hours of internet per month, how about that? And for speeds of 128 kilobytes per second, whoa, like a dial-up modem. $5 a month. And if you want the maximum speed, which is 2 megabytes per second, yep, I said 2 megs. That's the fastest you can get at $105 a month, which no average Cuban person could ever afford. Now, if you want more than 30 hours of internet a month, you have to pay an extra $1.50 an hour. So, they're opening up internet to private individuals, but no one can afford it. Up to now, the connection in homes has been allowed only to some professionals like doctors, journalists, and academics, which required government authorization. Number 9, there's never much at all in the supermarkets. That is, if you can even find a supermarket. In fact, there are barely any shops, as we know them, of any kind. Number 10, the locals who don't have U.S. dollars or cash have to line up to get boxes of matches, sugar, oil, and government bread coming from government bakeries. And of course, you know how much pride government employees have in their work. So the bread is basically crap. Number 11, they've created a so-called tourist currency just to make it easier to gouge tourists. Number 12, Havana has one of the worst airports in the world with no Wi-Fi or phones that work. So if you have a problem with a visa or a flight or it comes in way too late, for example, you're absolutely 100% screwed. Number 13, service is slow and heartless. It's clear no one gives a crap about anything. Number 14, there are only 8 TV stations, all total crap and propaganda. Outside TV stations are banned. There is still a kind of a fear instilled in the people's minds and hearts. They're not willing to open up. After a while, as a tourist, especially as a resident, it wears you down and sucks the energy out of you. Then he says, of course, there are lots of good things about Cuba. Most of the people are quite nice, considering their situation. Haircuts are really cheap, and they've got the best cigars in the world. So, bottom line, the next time you see blogs, International Living, or anyone else trying to sell you on the idea of living, retiring, or investing in Cuba, don't say I didn't warn you. By the way, the object of a Plan B is to get residency and a passport, right? Well, a Cuban passport is rated as one of the worst travel documents in the world.
South of the border.
This is the Expat Files, living in Latin America. If you want me to help you out with your own Plan B, just schedule a one-on-one consult. Send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to learn how to move forward with your own Plan B from right up there in the States, go to www.expatplanb.com and check out my 3 videos. See ya. Nos vemos.